Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about writing about animals, critter tales, yours, mine, and ours, and we're going to be speaking to the folks from the Santa Fe Community College about what's going on over there. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bill Burke White. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our monthly foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Bill.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you and your listeners again.
Yes, it is indeed. Now, there's an amazing thing that's happened President Obama has done in his first days in office, and that is he has signed an executive order whereby Guantanamo as prison camp would be closed. What is the intent of this order, and how is it to be carried out?
Well, you're right. For the past 4 or 5 years, you and I have talked frequently about the horrors of what happened in Guantanamo Bay and the other secret prisons, and to his credit, Obama carried through on one of his promises in the campaign, which was to at least order the closing of Guantanamo Bay. And on his second day in office, he issued an executive order mandating that the prison camp in Guantanamo Bay be closed within 1 year. And on one hand, it's a very important symbolic gesture to say that he really is intent on changing the Bush administration policies. If you're a detainee in Guantanamo Bay, your life didn't change very much with the signing of that executive order, in the sense that it gives the government 1 year to close Guantanamo. The problem, of course, is figuring out what to do with the 250 or so people still remaining in Guantanamo Bay. So the order itself is significant in its symbolic value, but now comes the really hard work. The government has essentially bought themselves 1 year to figure out what to do with each of those 250 prisoners, and we're going to have to watch very closely to see where that goes over the next, now they've got about 350 days left to figure that out.
In theory, by the standards of American law, everybody in prison is innocent till proven guilty, and they have to be tried by a jury of their peers. Obviously, this is a set of different rules apply because it's wartime, although these prisoners are not, I think, technically classified as prisoners of war. What is to be their fate in accordance with the law of our land?
So you're right. Under a normal American judicial system, one is innocent till proven guilty, and you can be detained, obviously, awaiting trial, particularly if there's a risk that you're going to commit another crime or flee. You won't get bail, and you'll be held until you're tried. The other category of people out there are prisoners of war, and they can actually be detained without trial until the end of a conflict. And the Bush administration, obviously, in 2001, had the choice of declaring that the people who were captured were prisoners of war. They didn't take that approach and instead sort of detained the people at Guantanamo Bay in a kind of legal limbo. And the Obama administration now has to figure out how to unwind that. And if at its peak, Guantanamo had about 700 people detained there, many of whom were people who shouldn't have been detained. They were handed over by the Taliban in Afghanistan or handed over by enemies of one sort or another in Afghanistan without really having done anything dangerous to the United States. Many of those people have now been released or sent back to their home countries, and we're down to about 250. So what do we do with those 250? Some of them can be returned home. Many of them come from countries in the Middle East, and they can be sent back to their home countries. Some of those countries have refused to cooperate with the Bush administration, and one of the things Obama will need to do is to mend fences and repair relations with some of our European allies and some countries in the Middle East to seek to send probably, I would think, about 100 of those 250 back home. Those would be people who are not an ongoing threat, who there's no real evidence that they committed crimes, or where their home countries can be trusted to try them fairly at home and sentence them properly at home. Then there's another group that you simply cannot send back to their home countries. Perhaps because their home countries still won't take them, or perhaps because their home countries are countries that have been involved in acts of torture, for example, Egypt or Syria, that have a policy of torturing prisoners. Under international law, we cannot send people back where they face torture. And even if those countries say they won't torture, can we really believe it? So you're now down to about 150 who you can't send home. Many of those can be tried in the United States, and they would be taken from Guantanamo, sent back to prisons in the United States, and be classified as normal prisoners who committed crimes and face trial in U.S. courts. And there are mechanisms available to U.S. courts to protect some secret information in those trials. For example, in the World Trade Center trials, there were certain, the first time those were bombed, I should say, there was certain information that wasn't revealed in the press and that the judges can look at under special conditions, and those conditions might apply, but they would really be normal American trials, and they would say to the world that U.S. courts are free and fair and that U.S. courts can deal even with serious allegations of terrorism or threats to the United States. The problem really arises with the last handful of detainees, and these would be detainees who probably were tortured by the Bush administration policies, and against whom there is serious evidence that they did commit crimes or would intend to continue to commit crimes against Americans. But that evidence cannot be used and is somewhat questionable because it was obtained through torture. So those people you can't try because the evidence you have against them is tainted, and you also can't send them home because to do so would subject them to further acts of torture. So those are the really hardest cases. And on one hand, you might say, well, if we can't try them fairly in a U.S. court because of our own conduct, perhaps we have no choice but to let them go. But can we really let those last two or three people loose on the streets of New York or Washington when there is pretty good evidence, even though tainted, that they are an ongoing threat to the United States? And that's the question that the Obama administration is really going to have to face within the next year, is what do you do with that group? Do you send them home to countries where they might be tortured or where they might be released and reappear in the Al-Qaeda network somewhere? Do you let them go in the United States and watch them carefully and hope that you can stop them if they are going to engage in further acts against America? Or do you put them in a U.S. prison without charges and detain them, in some ways violating your own commitment to civil liberties and to cleaning up the messes of the Bush administration, but perhaps necessarily so as a way of protecting America and American interests? And that's the hard part of closing Guantanamo. And at this point, it's unclear what the administration will do with that last handful of people.
To what extent is the evidence against the people you call the most dangerous ones it really, first of all, hard evidence and known to members of the public or members of the legal establishment?
It is generally not well known. You can read some of it in the New York Times that's leaked out over time. But the evidence usually falls into two categories, or perhaps I should say three categories. One is evidence that was acquired through torture. I'm skeptical of much of that evidence, but it is out there, and it taints the proceedings. So if you excluded that evidence, then you're left with evidence that might have been given by other suspects at Guantanamo or elsewhere. And that evidence is also perhaps not very reliable. And then you're also often will have evidence that was obtained through non-torture methods, but that the sources are and must be kept secret because they might reveal the location of informants that the United States has within Al-Qaeda or elsewhere. And so you can't use that evidence either. And that evidence may well be reliable. Somebody needs to look very hard at it and make a decision as as to whether it's reliable. But where the question really comes down to is if you've got evidence that seems on the whole to suggest that these people, and again, it's a very small number of them, really are ongoing threats to the United States, but that you cannot try them, what do you do with them? You want to minimize that number, obviously, but there may well be a few people who really do appear to be threats to this country, and then you don't know what you're going to do with those few people.
And that is something, do we have precedents for that type of situation?
Well, the classic precedent, of course, is prisoners of war. For example, in World War II, a group of German spies snuck into the United States on a submarine. The submarine pulled up off the coast of Long Island. They swam ashore in civilian clothing, eventually were caught, and were a continuing threat to the United States. If you released them, they were fully intent on blowing up whatever they could blow up and furthering Germany's cause during the war. So that kind of class of people would be detained and tried, either detained and tried as criminals or considered prisoners of war. That group themselves weren't prisoners of war because they snuck into the United States illegally, and they could be tried on that grounds. If they're prisoners of war, you hold them to the end of the conflict and then release them. But when does the conflict with al-Qaeda end? Very hard to know, and the change in administration doesn't help give us an end date to it. Or you try them domestically. But there's not very good precedent for what you do when you can't try them domestically because of the, your own conduct with respect to torture under the Bush administration. My guess is what the Obama administration might ultimately do with that last handful of people is transfer them to custody in the continental United States in a normal maximum security prison, give them a right of habeas corpus to challenge their detention in a U.S. court, but then assert privileges with respect to state secrets that they cannot release that information necessary to try them, but be public about it and say we're holding four people or five people and we're going to detain them as long as we believe they are a continuing threat to the United States. And that may well violate what Obama pledged in the beginning throughout his campaign, but it may be necessary in order to protect this country.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. The mess that Guantanamo became very quickly after it was opened and the mess of the secret CIA prisons and the rendition and torture that's happened at all of these different places has created really an international scandal. But what if the if this whole 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, Al Qaeda, and all of these conflicts had taken place under an administration that cared more about the rule of law than the Bush administration seemed to? What would they have done? In other words, what is the right way to go about handling foreign terrorists?
Well, the first thing they should have done is exactly what Obama did on his second day in office, which was to pass an executive order forbidding torture. The executive order essentially says that any interrogation conducted by any officer of the United States government, including the CIA, must comply with the Army Field Manual. And the Army Field Manual is essentially the documents that the book that governs the conduct of U.S. Soldiers, and it explicitly forbids and prohibits torture and requires compliance with the Geneva Conventions on the Law of War. They should have done that in part because if they'd done that, we wouldn't have the mess we have now with the last few detainees who we can't try because we tortured them. The second thing they should have done is not rushed so quickly to develop the policies of Guantanamo, but thought really hard and realized that the U.S. system and the laws of war provided a sufficient legal basis to deal with the likes of al-Qaeda. Essentially, you had two options. One option was to declare people prisoners of war and detain them until the end of the conflict. That's clearly part of the laws of war and completely allowable. There would be rights for the Red Cross and others to visit those people, so it wouldn't be a secret detention. But you could detain them as long as you need until the conflict is over. And given the nature of this conflict, one could make a pretty good case that the conflict is still going on and may go on for some time further, so you could easily still be detaining those people that you felt you still needed to detain. The other approach would have been to treat them as ordinary criminals and prosecute them, either in U.S. courts or extradite them to countries that would prosecute them. And that would have been a way of dealing with many of the detainees against whom you do have some kind of usable evidence. And maybe you can't prosecute them for attempting to, commit a crime on 9/11 to blow up the Pentagon or the Twin Towers. But even if you could only get them on a lesser crime, you could still convict them and jail them and incapacitate them so they weren't an ongoing threat. So those mechanisms would have been sufficient had the Bush administration sought to do that back in 2001.
President Obama has made some appointments to his administration of people who actually are attorneys representing or who represented prisoners in Guantanamo. That's an extraordinary thing. What are they doing? What is their role?
So this is perhaps the most important aspect of Obama's first few weeks in terms of dealing with Guantanamo and cleaning up the horrors of the Bush administration. He appointed some very smart and very experienced people who have worked defending Guantanamo Bay detainees into two key offices within the U.S. government. The first is the Office of Legal Counsel, and that is an office within the Department of Justice that can issue binding legal opinions about the nature of the law and the status of the law that effectively bind other elements of the U.S. government, including the White House and the President. And that's the office that issued the famous torture memo by John Yoo during the Bush administration that said, it's not torture if we don't kill the person and go ahead and torture, essentially. The two of the most senior figures there are Don Johnson, a law professor from Indiana, and Marty Lederman. And Marty has been long involved in Guantanamo defense issues. They know this area of the law extremely well. They've worked on it from the defense side. They are absolutely committed to restoring the rule of law and righting the wrongs of the Bush administration era. The other office where there have been very significant appointments in this regard is the Office of the Solicitor General. Again, the Solicitor General is within the Department of Justice, and she is tasked with defending the government or asserting the government position before the U.S. Supreme Court or any other court in the country when an interest of the U.S. government is at stake. And the new Solicitor General is a woman named Elena Kagan. She was actually my law professor when I was a law student at Harvard, most recently the dean of the Harvard Law School, and someone very much committed to the rule of law. And one of her principal deputies is a gentleman named Neil Katyal. And Neil teaches at Georgetown Law School and defended Hamdan in the most important Supreme Court case about Guantanamo detentions called Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. And he was actually asserting Hamdan's position that he had a right to challenge his detention in the United States and that he was being illegally detained. And so those appointments really signal a willingness by this administration to change position, to rethink what they're doing, and to restore the rule of law that the Bush administration so horribly tore down.
At the same time, we had earlier this week a situation in which lawyers for the Obama administration were making a case for state secrecy and seemed to be really just continuing Bush policies on secret prisons. Tell us about that case.
So this was actually a case out in California on the Ninth Circuit, and it involved a claim by some of the detainees from Guantanamo Bay against Boeing. And Boeing was being sued because Boeing had been involved in those secret flights that the Bush administration used to transfer prisoners from Afghanistan to secret prisons in Afghanistan, or to Guantanamo, or to other countries to face torture. And the Bush administration asserted a little-known doctrine called the State Secrets Doctrine. And the State Secrets Doctrine is a doctrine that says that if a litigation depends on revealing state secrets that would damage the country in some important way, the government can ask the courts not to allow that litigation to proceed, or at least not to allow evidence to be used that would damage the United States. And the Bush administration asserted the state secrets doctrine in every case they could possibly assert it in. And what was surprising was that when this case was heard last week, the judges began by asking the government lawyer, also from the Solicitor General's office, whether anything historic had happened that might have changed the government's position since the last hearing. And the attorney for the government said, no, Your Honor. And the judge then said, well, what about the presidential election and the change of administration? And the government lawyer responded that the new administration had reviewed the policies, and it was his position as representing the government to continue to assert the state secrets doctrine in this case. It was a bit of a surprise to those of us who have been expecting a radical change from the Obama administration. They were still asking the courts to keep that material secret. Now, one can look at this in a couple of different ways. One way is to be very disheartened that there had not yet been a real change of policy, and that perhaps all of the talk of change from the Obama administration was faulty. A second way to look at it would be to say that the Obama administration is still figuring out what their position is going to be. They've only been in office for less than 3 weeks, or just, I guess, a day or two over 3 weeks now. Many of their senior officials are still being confirmed by the Senate, and they have hundreds of cases to look at and figure out what the positions are going to be. So it may simply be a matter of taking the time to get the legal positions correct, rather than an indication that they're not going to change position. And finally, it may also be that the evidence in this case is, in fact, so dangerous to the United States that it is appropriate to assert the state secrets doctrine. And we're going to have to watch carefully what develops here, but it was certainly not a favorable development for those of us who are trying to see that that the wrongs of the Bush administration are brought out into the public and rectified.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. It seems to me, looking at Obama's resume and the positions that he's taking so far and everything he said in his campaign, that he really is somebody who takes the rule of law very seriously. Do you see him going forward in prosecuting those in the previous administration who may have committed serious crimes?
On the first part of your comment, I think you're exactly right. He is a law professor. He is trained as a lawyer. He, I think, understands how important it is that our country, our military, our foreign policy be governed by the rule of law, that the government itself be constrained by that law, and that even the president be subject to the law. And all of his appointments are a very clear indication that looking forward, he wants to ensure that his government is constrained by the law. Everyone appointed to the White House Counsel's Office, where Alberto Gonzalez started his career in the Bush administration, are now very serious lawyers intent on keeping the government constrained. The Office of the Legal Counsel, the Solicitor General, the expected appointments in the Legal Advisor's Office at State, all of those are a signal about the future that this government will be constrained by the rule of law. There was talk by some people who were ultimately appointed to the Obama administration that they wanted to prosecute the members of the Bush administration, Rumsfeld and Alberto Gonzalez and John Yoo and others, who allowed these acts of torture to take place. But we saw a very interesting thing happen during the confirmation hearings. For example, the new attorney general, in the first part of his confirmation hearings, made some statements suggesting that the Bush administration had committed torture. In the second part of his confirmation hearings, he changed his tune slightly and said that acts like waterboarding might well be torture or are torture, but that they couldn't say for sure whether the Bush administration had committed acts of torture. That was a very important signal. It was an important signal because it indicates that the new Obama administration does not plan on, in fact, prosecuting people in the Bush administration. If they had said outright that the acts of the Bush administration were torture, they would be legally obligated to prosecute those acts of torture. So by hedging and not saying it was torture, they were giving themselves some leeway not to proceed with prosecutions. And I think it's very unlikely that we will see anyone prosecuted for acts of torture under the Bush administration.
And why would they not do that if they care so much about the rule of law?
I think ultimately it's a strategic calculation. It's a calculation that says that the political costs of prosecuting Bush officials are extraordinarily high. That it would create a major rift and division within the country. It would probably stall or freeze up any movement in the Senate or in the House of Representatives to pass other legislation, and that it would really be the defining mark of the Obama administration would be a prosecution of the last 4 years. And Obama, who promised change, who promised a new beginning, a new dawn, wants to look forward. He's facing extraordinary financial crisis in the United States, global foreign policy challenges of the highest order, and I think he has decided that he wants to use his political capital, his time, and his energy to solve those problems that the American people are facing rather than to take us back through the past 8 years again through what would be very ugly and politically messy prosecutions. It's a disappointment to those of us who think it's very important to assert the rule of law and to punish those who were guilty of torture, but it's probably a strategically necessary calculation given the agenda that Obama has and the challenges that we all face at the moment.
Bill Birkwhite is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he joins us about once a month here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Bill, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and have a good afternoon.
You too. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR.